Hello, dear listeners. I sit ensconced in the Rack Addict studio. Hooray!
We have actually transcended the cars. We're in a new format. We're not going back to our spiritual home just yet, the pub. We're going to leapfrog that situation. Professional, controlled sound. Indoors. I've got a cup of tea. It's all very civilized. But I'm here with Pete. And of course, you're listening to Rack Addicts After Hours, episode 74. And we just had a hailstorm in what is supposedly nearly summer. That's England for you. How have you been, Pete? I can actually see your face. There's a mic stand in the way, but this time there aren't car windows in the way.
I much prefer this situation.
It's always better. The only improvement could possibly be the chinking of ice, or if it was outside but we didn't have to worry about wind noise. That would be nice, but hailstorms.
We can do that.
Yeah.
We can definitely do that. We have
when flexibility.
When we get some proper weather, proper summer weather.
Assuming we ever do. Yes, any news on your front? I know you were chatting to the chap behind the Omsonic bits and pieces. And you got some news on that front?
Yes, I have been digging in a bit deeper. And it seems that there is more to the Sarcastic Inspiration generator than I thought, which is really good because I was already really chuffed with it as it was.
It just gets better and better.
Just using it out of the box. But certainly it was pointed out to me that there is a lot more functionality under the covers.
Pray tell, what are we looking at?
There is a certain amount. I wouldn't describe it as memory. I'd said last week there was a loop function.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also a way of freezing all the parameters or grabbing all the parameters for a particular setup, and they are stored in some sort of memory. So there's not multiple memories. So there's not a bank of memories that you can select from or chain link together or move between. But you can, if you have a particularly good setup or patch, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, well, you'd be safe for a power cycle of the case,
at least.
Yes,
that's the primary reason. But there is a whole host of other really subtle things that you can do. So although it's not obvious looking at the control surface, but there's a certain amount of multifunction with the buttons and so forth.
The old kind of shift and press type combinations.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I have got the manual, which is quite extensive. It runs to something like 25 pages.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of goodness in it. I've only just started dipping in at the moment and sort of figuring out what's what with it.
Gotcha. But definitely a hit.
Yes. Yes, it's totally, I'm completely inspired now to really move forward and get my mobile modular system ready for the summer.
Excellent. Farewell Melodicer, perhaps. And we were talking earlier, potentially, another outdoor modcaf coming soon. We previously had one in a forest in the woodlands, which I'm still gutted I didn't go to. I can't remember what excuse I made. I hope I was doing something fun. I think we set it up so that there were different performers spaced out doing their own thing and people could kind of wander through. Lots of people had lighting as well. So you wander through this lit woodland and listen to strange synthesized noises. So if you're up for joining in on that kind of vibe, then I think we've got more where that came from. And we should film it. We should definitely film it and get it on the YouTube channel again.
Was it filmed previously?
I think so. I don't know that we actually put any of it online because it was mostly people's phone footage. But sometimes Ian, Ian's the guy who does all the fun trailers with the weird glitchy noises and the strange humour. I think we'll see if we can get him to put a wrap-up video in that style, put that on the YouTube channel because those are really fun. Hunting through my news stories, getting rid of pop-up ads because they're everywhere. There's no news from me on the personal front, apart from the fact that I've spent too much money on coffee once more. But we do have a few bits to discuss. The first, a very short headline. There's a new noir, a black version of the Matrix Brute. It looks pretty swish, but I do miss the wooden panels, the obvious wooden panels of the real one. We were saying earlier, it's sort of been overshadowed now by the Polybrute and how much acclaim that's got, but the Matrix Brute really is a capable synthesizer, and though there's a lot going on and that sort of modulation matrix does look intimidating, we like it, though your back doesn't like it.
No, I mean, it is extremely heavy, but it did have a lot of respect in the modular scene because of the ability to almost route anything to anything.
Yeah, it's pretty much completely open in that sense. I also liked having the e-ink display. for the extra modulation slots. I thought that's quite a fun touch.
I mean, I almost purchased one. Oh, yeah. I was just slightly hesitant and left it. And then, as I say, when the Polybrute became a thing, that was the end. The Polybrute was the only one for me.
The only way forwards. Well, this one is limited to 500 units, and I don't think this has actually been announced yet. I think this is leaked from Sweetwater. They do seem to do that quite a lot, unfortunately. But no, it looks nice, and I'm always a sucker for the control panel lifting up, as I'm sure I've said before.
So it would seem that they have the intention to continue, or certainly in this sort of noir format at least. Do you think they will eventually drop it as a product now they've got the Polybrute?
It's a good question. Most of the other limited edition colourways haven't heralded the end times. The black versions of the Beat Step, the Key Step, and those things, they've come and gone, but the products are still available. Micro Freak had a limited edition white one when it came with the vocoder, but that's still hanging about. They did a few different colours of the Micro Brute as well, but yeah, I don't know the time scales off the top of my head, but those limited edition colours weren't kind of a last hurrah and end.
Yes, I totally get what you're saying. But some of those products are real stalwarts, especially the Beat Step and the Key Step.
Absolutely. I'm kind of sad that the Micro Brute went, though. That was a really fun little box. The keyboard was terrible, but great value. Good fun.
There must have been some sort of rationale. I mean, I would imagine at the end of the day, it really is all about numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how well a product's selling, or maybe they have some other thing up their sleeve, or maybe issues with production. You have to, as you expand the range of products, there's certain ones you possibly have to let go because they're not
practical
to continue with.
Indeed. I did like the crystal plastic cases, the kind of see-through ones. They were fun. Anyway, the next one that I did want to ask you about, get your opinion on, have you heard about Sennheiser? And we've had thunder, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully we don't get a lightning strike on the house. Anyway, Sennheiser, they have sold the consumer audio part of the business, which, as far as I know, is just headphones.
What, consumer headphones rather than
all the headphones.
Because
I was thinking, okay, maybe the HD 600 and 650 are safe. But no, if you go through the website to find them, they definitely come through the consumer corner. And they'd kind of been on my radar as if I want to get a proper mixing, editing, something headphone. Either of those, 600 or 650 would be it. The hi-fi world and the Sennheiser audio enthusiast world are going, oh, the companies, it's all over, it's going to be terrible. What do you think? Have you encountered this before where a big company, you know, offloads half of his business? In this case, it's a Swiss-based company who do hearing aids, called Sonova Holding AG, hearing aids and cochlear implants.
There ought to be a distinct reason why you would sell a big proportion of your business in that respect.
From what I know, I think it wasn't especially profitable for them because of the amount of R&D they did. There was quite a good section of the WAN show from the Linus Tech Tips channel that went into detail on this, but I think that must have been part of the reason it just wasn't that profitable.
And did they do everything in-house, or were they
I'm pretty sure
teaming up with anyone else? I mean, it sounds as though it might be a better fit with the company that's purchased it, as they're into auditory things.
It could be. Actually, consumer audio does also include soundbars and DACs. Those are the other two branches.
And DACs are a bit specialised, aren't they, in some respects? Yeah. A real sort of
high-fi DACs, ones, probably.
High-end converters.
But yeah, have you seen this kind of thing happen before? A section of a business disappearing to other hands and then
always a reason. I mean, is it a case that this company approached them and made them an offer they couldn't refuse, or was it they were looking for someone to take it off their hands?
Because Sennheiser were seeking a buyer in this case.
Then there's got to be a motivation by it. Mm. There's got to be some rationale that says we no longer want to be in this business. It's either too difficult, too problematic, or just not profitable enough, or even loss-making.
Time will tell. I know that the main worry was, will the quality of the headphones disappear?
Do you think they're still going to do in-ear stuff with their wireless?
That's part of the, you know, the list of products in that category is all the wireless headphones, earbuds, however you want to call those.
So they've gone as well?
Yeah, that's all in the sale too.
That's a bit strange, isn't it?
Mm.
Because, you know, they do quite a lot of wireless products for microphones, and I always think of them as being somewhat in the same family.
Yeah.
The sort of base stations and the setup.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We'll keep an eye on it. But what I did notice is all of the stock for HD 600 and 650 is just gone. Lots of people have just been going, oh, snap it up before they go weird.
I mean, is there any pledge from the new owners or the people that have got those product lines that are going to continue with them? Or
not that I've seen, not on either direction, that they're going to keep stuff or ditch it.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what their motivation to buy it was, what they were trying to, you know, they think we could do it, make a better fist of it, or there's some key technology or something that they want to get their hands on. I mean, who knows what the sort of machinations that go on in these boardrooms.
From the What Hi-Fi article, Sennheiser's co-CEOs were buoyed by the move, suggesting it could open more opportunities for Sennheiser speech-enabled hearables and both true wireless and audiophile headphones. Who knows?
I suspect they were quite pleased to get rid of it. Potentially. But what I've also found in these situations, quite a lot of staff jump ship because, you know, it's not just products, it's premises and staff, isn't it?
Yeah.
And senior management as well. I can imagine that, you know, that'll be a whole division, won't it, within that company?
Indeed.
So where's Sennheiser based? Germany, I would imagine.
That's a very good question. I must know. I can never spell it right the first time when I type it in. Sennheiser. Germany, yes indeed.
And the new owners are Swiss based?
Yes.
I would imagine, I mean, I don't know if there's any separation, whether the headphone division was actually located in separate buildings, because how do you pull something like that apart?
Yeah, from another Linus Tech Tips video, because they toured, well, they had a tour of the Sennheiser facility, and I think they just did kind of the headphone corner of it, and I think that was a separate facility.
Yeah, then that's easy to separate that off, and I would imagine initially nothing will change apart from the branding. That'll have to change, won't it? So what they're going to be calling it something else.
I think they're keeping the Sennheiser branding.
So it's still going to be called Sennheiser headphones?
Yes, indeed.
That's a bit of a strange thing.
It'll still be under the Sennheiser brand for the headphones, at least.
So is that two companies both using the brand name Sennheiser now?
Yep, very, very confusing.
Yeah, how does that work?
I don't know. Well, maybe it will help the hearing aids and cochlear implant company get a bit more recognition, because Sennheiser is a big name.
Yes, certainly, of course. Obviously aware of the microphones, but what else do they make?
So there's obviously the shotgun microphones that are very famous, like the MKH-416. That's a big one. Studio recording microphones, like the 421, that microphone with the worst designed mic clip in the world. You know, the one that's like a phaser from Star Trek.
And there's lots of dynamic mics, because we've got all sorts of different models. I mean, there's...
Yeah, they've done some stuff with immersive audio, so immersive microphones. And then one avenue that I wasn't aware of is definitely the sound bars. I didn't know that was a thing they did at all.
But yeah. I'm struggling to think of any other products, because we only really stock the headphones and the mics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Oh, and obviously the wireless systems to accompany those.
That seems to be the extent of it. They do some more video oriented stuff. They have some good wireless systems for on camera audio, that kind of stuff.
It all tends to be rather pricey as well. It's the sort of real top end stuff.
Anyway, let us move on. We were chatting in the other room when we were talking about the Omsonic. You are potentially interested in chatting about permanent fixtures, favourite parts, and design your perfect modular system type thing. Obviously, impossible to do in the scope of a reasonably short podcast, because that could go on forever. But I would like to ask you what you're planning to have in your small portable case, and how big it'll be, how you're going to make it, all these kind of things.
It's going to be 2 rows of 84 HP, so quite
standard,
modest, very portable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a case of choosing the best and the most optimized modules, and I've got that extra restriction that they've all got to be black or black, black face paint.
Yeah, so the black case for your portable stuff, and then the silver for the studio.
Yes, so obviously I have the Stochastic Inspiration Generator.
Mm-hmm.
I have the Mimeophone.
Oh, yes, very
and
nice.
And I just installed a black faceplate on one of my radio music.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that looks swish.
Modules. I am going to purchase, most probably next week, one of the Endorphins Noir.
The Black Noir, the
Black
drum
Noir
machine.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you going to sequence that for?
That is the problem. I've been sort of looking at various trigger units or sequencing units.
You can always combine the semi-random bits of the Stochastic Inspiration Generator. What's the acronym for that? SIG. Anyway, you might want more predictable for kicks and snares, potentially.
Do you know of anything that is sort of, you know, you put MIDI in and you get on some sort of memory card or something like that. So it's self-contained. It's not receiving MIDI from a computer.
Oh, so you load in a MIDI file.
So you load in MIDI files and it spits out the appropriate CVs and you can change, you know, that would be, if there's something such as that, that would be an interesting thing. I note that a lot of them I see seem to emulate sort of Roland type stuff, 808, 909 type of control configurations.
I believe, because what can't it do? The Disting might be able to help. I had thought there's one, I think it's called Nutella from Tesseract Audio Modular or something, but that's actually just a WAV file player, but it can play multiple outputs at once, so you could play a surround sound audio file from it. No, is the answer. I don't know of one.
I mean, I've had a few and still have some. I've got the Noise Engineering.
Sequencer.
Drum
or,
trigger.
Oh, Zularic Repetitor.
Yeah.
Aha! I don't know if that's the one.
That's exactly the one I've got, the Zularic Repetitor.
Let's have a look. Surfing Modular Grid right now, as I often do. Dynamic Rhythm Generator. Oh, yes, there we go.
And I have the Mutable Instrument one, which again escapes me, but it only does three drums.
Grids.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to get an alternative panel for that, but that would
I mean, that's
work.
Not a problem. You can get those quite easily. I've seen some people that have two grids, giving them six different drums.
Yeah, on the MIDI file playback front, it looks like Disting or general CV both from Expert Sleepers.
Does the Disting do that standalone or does it?
One channel though.
Okay.
So maybe not.
No.
And you'd need the little MIDI breakout, I think, potentially.
I just had a vision. Maybe someone needs to design and make one of these.
Maybe. It might be that it's kind of the antithesis of what modular is, going back to a MIDI file in some cases, depending on what kind of sequencing style you like.
Yeah, I suppose so, but it would be nice though, wouldn't it?
It could be. I'd hate to have that workflow, you know, go into a computer, type something out in a grid, file, SD card, move it to the thing. Don't think that would work for me at all.
Yeah, possibly. But so you want something that's dynamic that you can sort of work with in a live situation, or something, or presets, or
as I've mentioned many times before, the Euclidean circles always works for me so well. Though you can't save sequences on it because it's more of a trigger sequencer, it's so quick and visual and easy.
Well, I'm just thinking of having a certain amount. I know that it's all supposed to be all in the moment, but I'm thinking of having something that is a bit more predictable, something that you can recreate, you know, you can design a performance and you can carry it out without it.
Well, if you like
turning into a hot mess,
that kind of stuff, the Squarp Hermod might work.
Possibly. Is it a general sequencer or is it?
General sequencer. It can do MIDI and it has like 8 tracks of outputs for modular.
The trouble with all these sequences, they're eye-wateringly expensive.
Yeah, that's probably what we're talking, 400 or 500 this
all one. The ones I've looked at are all in the sort of £500-600 mark.
Squarp Hermod, 400.
Oh,
409.
Almost sounds reasonable. Only 400.
Only, yes indeed. Small screen, which is a little irritating for some.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like something small that just works.
Yeah. If you wanted to get the Metropolis happening in your system, there is the M185 from RYK Modular, which is the guy who originally designed it for the Roland modular format.
But it's still just a sequencer. I know it can do multi-pattern, but
it is good fun.
Yeah, no, I note that...
You've got one, of course, you know all about it.
But there's the... What's the new one called?
Metropolix,
that's it. So, I mean, that one seems to be available now from what I could saw. I think people have actually got stock of the things. Right.
Yeah, 500, 525... Howie.
Yeah, not cheap at all.
All this talk of sequencers has me hankering after the Turing machine again, an old favourite.
You can always build one.
That will be the plan. I did, well, last time I was modularing anyway, I was thinking, oh yeah, I'll... Yeah, portable, confined, small space. But I think I mentioned on a previous podcast, my current plan is to get one of the Ginkgo Synthes DIY cases, which is something like 142 HP wide and 5 rows tall, and it's absurdly cheap. That was when I was talking about my spreadsheet of cost per HP back in whatever episode that might have been. I still got that here. Yes, I do. I've still got my cost per HP table. And of course, the Behringer case won. But having now used it, don't really want to go near it.
Well, here's some more options in the respect of drum sequencing. Of course, you've got the things like the Tip Top Audio Trigger Riot, an old faithful one there. Another one that's caught my eye, but again, it's a bit pricey, is the Erica Synths drum sequencer.
Yeah, is that the one with the mechanical keys?
Well, it's certainly
like keyboard keys.
Yeah, are they clickety click?
I haven't seen a video where you can hear a clickety clack, but it would be nice to have that tactile feeling.
But we're talking 546 $99.
Ouch.
It's quite expensive for something that doesn't actually make any noise.
Yeah, so those Ginkgo Synthes cases, we're talking just over £1 per HP.
So the other thing I was thinking about is clocking, general having...
Yes.
And obviously I could use either the drum sequencer or the stochastic inspiration generator, but neither of these, or neither of the ones that I'm looking at, have anything that shows you what the BPM is.
Ah, so, that's a good point.
So I'm thinking maybe a Pamela's new workout or a Tempi, yeah, or something like that.
Pam's will definitely do it. Trying to think if I know anything else. I was thinking in terms of clock distribution, the quad clock distributor from 4MS is really great because it's just, you know, four channels of multiplication, division. That's really handy if you've got a lot of sequences happening.
As long as I've got a clear readout that says it's running at X BPM.
Yeah.
So I know what's going on.
Yeah, Tip Top Trigger Riot will do that, but that's just a different workflow altogether. No, probably PAMS. PAMS will be the way. And there is a black panel available now, which I don't think there was for a good while.
Well, the Trigger Riot's been around forever. Forever, literally.
That was one of the first videos I watched, the Mylar Melodies Trigger Riot video. I thought, oh, this is an interesting way of working.
I would imagine at some stage back in the past, I would have considered purchasing one, but it does, it's so unconventional to look at. So
yeah.
I mean, there's some really horrendous. There's another one here, WMD Metron 16-channel trigger and gate sequencer.
600.
Yes.
Ah, no. Too many.
So Makako voltage block 8-channel.
Oh, the voltage block's cool. I don't think you have a readout on that for BPM.
Is it a generic one again, or is it just drums?
Voltage block is more of a modulation one. It's 16 faders of either minus 5 to plus 5 or 0 to 10 or something.
Yep, and I've never really worked out why, because Tip Top have also got the Z8000, which is the matrix sequencer, which looks a bit like the Trigger Riot. So I've never figured out, you know, obviously there are design differences, but what makes them different sequencers? Because it's still got the same sort of weird matrix of potentiometers.
I've never really understood what matrix mixers, sequencers kind of do. So I couldn't really comment on that one. I think that's more of a voltage source rather than a trigger source.
Now, I'm currently having a lot of fun with my IntelliGel Atlantis.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't say it's cheating, but it is a whole synth voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, do I try and get something similar with a black faceplate? Or...
Well, it is similar, because it's vaguely SH-101 flavoured,
yes, very much
it?
So. Or do I try and concoct something in individual modules to do the same job?
It'd probably be more expensive if you tried the concoction.
Yeah, certainly, but might give me more flexibility in the long run.
Could do. Always racking the brains to see what might be synth voice flavoured and black. Of course, any of the Moog semi-modulars, so the Mother 32 that you sold a while ago,
yeah,
would have worked. No Coast doesn't really count because you have to void the warranty to put it in a case. How about a Behringer Pro 1?
That's the sequencer, isn't it? The...
No, that's just the module.
Okay.
The Behringer Pro 1. Would you take Grey? Because there's the Deckard's voice that we spoke about on a podcast a while ago.
Yes, but, you know, what's that, 700?
Yeah, probably. It says it's 647 euros on Modular Grid anyway. Aha, the Pittsburgh Lifeforms.
Yes.
Range. Those are pretty cool.
Yes.
There's the SV1 is the more standard subtractive one. And I know you like your Pittsburgh. Your classic Pittsburgh is the silver stuff. But let's see. I can't remember what the other one, because they've got a slightly more West Coast flavoured full voice.
I mean, definitely want to get everything as dense as possible in the respect of features. Mm-hmm. And really pack a lot in.
The Lifeforms Voltage Lab, that's their West Coast flavoured synth voice, though I'm not sure how
it's
available
quite
it is.
A big thing, isn't it?
It's about the same size as an Atlantis, I think. It's what we're on here, about 48 HP.
That's big.
It is big for a, well, I mean, whole synth voice, the Atlantis is big.
Yeah, it's half a row, isn't it?
Yes indeed. There is, of course, things like the Dope for Mini synth voices, which are, you know, tiny. It's just a basic subtractive saw or square type thing. Those are okay. Sound good.
The main things that I'm really enjoying on the Atlantis is use of the envelopes.
How many have you got?
Well, you've only got the one, but it's what you can do with it. Well, you can have the thing cycling, so you get that sort of nice short attack.
Yeah.
And have it looping and then sequence that, and it makes for a very...
I do like a looping envelope, actually.
And as long as I can recreate that, I'm quite happy to do that in individual modules, as long as I can get that functionality, because sometimes, I mean, you can struggle. You can have a plethora of modules and, you know, you've got to have the right bits and pieces.
Definitely. That's what I always tell people not to do, is don't start out your modular by trying to make a monophonic synth voice out of modules, because it's too much money. But that's exactly what I did when I started. We've had a ramble about the old modular stuff. Might it be time to take a voyage into the far beyond with Luke's Spacey Bit? Spacey, spacey time. Take it away, Luke. Keep us up to date on the happenings.
Hi, space fans, and welcome to our segment. We are back despite irksome reality-based delays, and we have some amazing news. If you've been living under a rock, you might have missed that CNSA landed their Zhurong rover on Mars on the 14th of May, making China only the second nation of Earth to successfully land on the Red Planet. Zhurong sent back black and white images of the view from above its lander vehicle, and on the 22nd of May it drove down the ramp and therein conducted its first motion tests. You may recall we spoke previously on the show about the Tianwen-1 orbiter mission to Mars, which featured a dual mission, taking a satellite to Mars and delivering a rover to the surface. Well, Zhurong is that rover. The pair have spent the last few months since entering Mars's orbit in February gravity braking, lowering the apoapsis of Tianwen-1's orbit and circularizing to the point where the rover could be safely deployed to the surface and face its own version of the JPL-dubbed 7 Minutes of Terror during its descent. Zhurong's mission to Mars is similar to that of the NASA JPL Curiosity rover, in that it will traverse the surface of Mars studying, among other things, the topography, geology, and chemistry of Utopia Planitia. The rover is solar-powered and designed to last for at least 90 days, but as with all spacecraft, hopefully it will massively exceed these parameters. As for the location itself, Utopia Planitia is a massive 3,300-kilometer diameter impact crater forming a colossal basin in the Martian northern hemisphere. Interestingly, the Perseverance, Curiosity, Spirit, InSight, and Viking 2 landers and rovers all landed in an approximate C-shape around this region. This is likely because of the presence of large amounts of ice beneath the surface of the red rock. If water was ever free-flowing on Mars, it was likely that Utopia Planitia formed some kind of seabed, which makes it an excellent candidate for exploration in the search for Martian-based life, or fossilized Martian-based life. You can view images of the Zhurong's first sights on Mars on the BBC website or on the CNSA page, where there are some short video clips showing the separation of the lander craft from the Tianwen-1 orbiter. Now moving on to some interesting anniversaries from this week. On the 25th of May 1961, John F. Kennedy gave his historic Moon Speech, in which he outlined the American government's policy of aggressive space research and exploration. Politics aside, it's a stirring performance that echoes the optimism and competition of the decade that saw in the greatest achievements of the space race, with both the USA and Soviet Union completing a range of historic firsts in space travel. I've mentioned the album previously on the show, but JFK's speech is movingly set to music on the fantastic concept album The Race for Space by Public Service Broadcasting. It features in a somber opening track set to a remittent angelic choir, which beautifully sets the tone for the events chronicled in the album. If you're into space and you want to feel chills, go and listen to this album and check out PSB in general, they're a great band. Also this week, in May 1971, we saw the launch of some of the earliest Martian probes. The Soviet Union made the first soft landing on the surface of Mars with their Mars 3 probe, and NASA followed suit with the Mariner 9 probe, becoming the first spacecraft to orbit the Red Planet. But for now, I thoroughly recommend checking out some images, particularly of the Soviet Mars and Venera programs, Venera being the mission to Venus, as the design is just absolutely out of this world. It really evokes that 50s and 60s design ethos. Looking at the Mars probes, it's easy to think of those flying saucer archetypes that became so popular back in the day. Well, that's it from me today, but before I go, I want you to thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Join us again next time for more space news and such, but for now, I'll return you to our co-hosts for the remainder of the episode. Stay safe, bye-bye.
And thank you as always. We do enjoy our spacey sojourn. That brings us through to our usual ending segment, the massively loved, I don't know. Multimedia, miscellaneous, recum, and mation. Yes, it's that bit where we fumble around for additional alliterations, fail horribly, and stumble over the actual title of the segment. Haha! Anyway, I do have one to show you. This will be a YouTube, even though I am trying to escape YouTube. As you can tell, it's not working at all. I'm going to give a little bit of a shout-out to one of our ModCaf mateys. This will be on the channel Synth Division. That's Synth Division. And this is a live visual dark techno performance from our mate Anthony. It's really, really cool. I believe Touch Designer was used for the visuals on this one. It's called OmniCharge. I just like it. It's a good one. There's some piano samples in there. I believe this was Electron, Octatrack, and Analog Rhythm, potentially. And also Yamaha Montage. I believe Anthony has the original Dark Trinity, so the old Analog Rhythm, Analog Keys, Octatrack. I think that's the trifecta. But yeah, give it a listen. 16 minutes, dark techno, and it's good fun. Pete, what have you got for us?
Right, another YouTube channel. Some months ago, I recommended a channel called Hoovy's Garage, which is one of these car YouTube channels.
I do remember.
Which of there are many. That channel is going great guns still. Certainly the subscription list has boomed, or whatever way you want to put it. One of his compatriots is a gentleman called Trevarish, or his channel is called Trevarish. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting in itself. It's a bit more hands-on, whereas Hoovy was actually getting a gentleman called the Car Wizard to do all the... all the grunt work and dirty stuff, and he just funded it and commentated. This gentleman actually gets his hands dirty and gets involved. His channel was quite interesting in that respect, if you like seeing people mechanicking. But they also do a series called Car Trek, which is featured on Trevarish's channel, and it also has Hoovy from Hoovy's Garage and one other YouTuber. And it's although it's sponsored by an aggregation website for car secondhand car purchasing and so forth, it's very much in the mold of Top Gear. So they are of a generation where they, I don't know, grew up on Top Gear. Top Gear is very popular around the world, including the USA. So they have done these episodes whereby they'll go on a kind of road trip. And they have challenges, and it's very, very Top Gear-y.
Definitely. Sounds good.
But they do it quite well, I have to say.
I don't even like cars that much, but I love Top Gear.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a good chemistry between the three presenters, and there's a certain amount of humour. But, so I just wanted to recommend the Trevarish's website. I'll spell that for you. It's Tavarish.
Lovely stuff. Well, if you're missing Top Gear or potentially the Grand Tour as well, since they are very similar flavours, you've got another option. As always, thank you so much for listening to Rack Addicts After Hours. We've been Ben and Pete, and we'll catch you in episode 75. Farewell.